You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 3 of a series in the book of Romans. Romans chapter 1, verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonouring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed for ever. Amen. For this reason God gave them up to dishonourable passions. For their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women, and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men, and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind, to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. We'll finish our reading there at the end of Romans 1, finishing with verse 32. Now, this is a lengthier section than we've looked at in the two previous episodes in this series, where we've looked at the first half of Romans 1, and you'll know if you've listened to that, that Paul is introducing in those verses at the beginning of the chapter the idea that he's going to present the gospel to the church in Rome, a church that he had not founded, but which he wanted to bless and he intended to visit. And so if the gospel is the good news of God's salvation through Jesus Christ, of his righteousness that verse 17 says is revealed from God from faith to faith, then we might wonder why in the very next verse, verse 18, Paul goes on to talk about God's wrath. That hardly sounds like good news, does it? But of course, Paul understands that until we realise the seriousness of our sin and its consequences, then the gospel is not good news to us. It doesn't seem like good news if we don't know that we need to be saved, that we need to be rescued. The gospel is good news because it deals with this horrible, horrific problem, the wrath of God. And that's what we need delivered from more than anything else. Now, I think what Paul says in this second half of Romans chapter 1 is profoundly countercultural in the moment that we live in. That might have become obvious to you as you listened to me reading it, particularly when Paul started to talk about homosexual activity. And that was very clear in verses 26 and 27. Where it talks about both the women exchanging natural relations for those contrary to nature, and the men giving up natural relations with women and being consumed with passion for one another, and so committing shameless acts with men. And of course, that may be something that causes hostility amongst some modern readers who think, what is the problem with homosexual activity? Because for the people who experience same-sex attraction, it is not contrary to nature, which is what the Apostle Paul says. Now, there are, of course, some people who claim to be Christians and to believe the Bible, who suggest that Paul isn't really talking here about homosexual activity, at least in a committed relationship, that what he's talking about was promiscuous homosexual activity. But I think any serious scholar of the Bible has to acknowledge that Paul doesn't make any such caveat here. And in the other places where he refers to homosexual activity, he very clearly is consistent with the Old Testament in saying that homosexual activity is sinful. And so from a Christian point of view, we believe that same-sex activity, and of course just as sexual activity outside marriage between a man and a woman of any kind, is sinful. It is not part of God's good intention for us. But we might easily get fixated on that activity, that action, and miss the point of what Paul is saying in this chapter. Now, Paul does not single that sin out as the only sin in the culture that surrounded him in the early first century or middle of the first century. Any more than we should single that out as the worst sin or the greatest of sins in the culture that we live in. But that sin for Paul does seem to be what we might call a marker of the spiritual condition of the culture. It's not the only sin. In fact, later on in the chapter, verse 29, the Apostle Paul lists a whole lot of kinds of sin: evil, covetousness, malice, envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness, gossip, slander, hating God, boastful, disobedient to parents, insolent, haughty, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. And I'm sure as you listen to a list like that, if you're honest, you have to say at least some of those words describe you. If you are a deceiver, if you've told lies for selfish gain, if you have envied, if you've boasted, if you've disobeyed your parents. And notice Paul doesn't put these sins in a gradation that some of them are worse than others, or that sexual sin is somehow, the only sin that we should be concerned about. But he does seem to single out homosexual activity as a marker of the fact that this is a culture that is far from God. And in a culture like that, all of these other things go on as well. They go on unchecked. Not only unchecked, but approved of, verse 32 says. It's not only that people do these things, but they give approval to those who practice them. Our culture, of course, today approves of homosexual activity. It talks about same-sex marriage and suggests that homosexual activity is perfectly respectable and acceptable. But it also approves of many of the other things that are described here. Attitudes of heart, of envy and haughtiness and boastfulness might actually be applauded in our culture. But our culture does not determine what is right and what is wrong. According to this passage, it's God who determines that. The decree of God. Verse 32, they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die. Now that seems to be a reference to the Old Testament law, which Paul will come to again in chapter 2 of Romans. So certainly Paul is aware of some people who have the law and who know that God has decreed that these things are sinful and that they deserve death. But earlier on in the chapter, Paul has talked not about the law as it was given through Moses and written in the scriptures, but the law that is actually written, as he'll say in chapter 2, on their hearts. The invisible attributes of God, verse 20, the eternal power and divine nature of God have been clearly perceived in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. So chapter 2 will talk about the law written on hearts and the operation of the conscience. the inner testimony, that the things, some things that we do are wrong, a feeling of guilt or of shame. But more foundationally than that, what Paul is talking about here in chapter 1, verse 20, is that there is ample evidence in the universe for the existence of God. As you look at the universe, as I look out my window right now and see a starling pecking at a fat ball and a pigeon trying to get at sunflower seeds in a feeder, well, and I look and see plants, leaves that are starting to come into bloom, trees that are starting to come into leaf, as I see grass and other plants that are growing, as I hear a car drive past with people behind the wheel, am I not meant to look at this and look at the sky with the clouds passing by and somewhere presumably behind them in my Irish climate is the sun? I can look at these things and I can see such beauty and order and such evidence of design. And I ought to look at that and conclude that there must be a creator and a designer who is very powerful. These are invisible things. I cannot see God. I can't see his power and his nature. But through the nature of those things that are created, I can see them. I can see that as even those who reject the existence of God and his involvement in creation will admit that the world looks like it was designed. The very nature of life. And the more we understand it as we look both at the very, very small, look at the DNA that codes for the proteins in our bodies and realize that there is a language there which is coding for a pattern. Well, doesn't that look like there must be an intelligence behind it? And on the other end of very, very large things, I look at a cosmos that works with such order, the planets revolving around the sun, the earth spinning on its axis, and the distance of the earth from the sun being just right for life to be sustained on this planet. And it looks like it was designed. And yet, the Apostle Paul says, people suppress the truth. They don't want to see that. The problem that we have whenever we don't believe that this world was created by an intelligent, powerful creator who is good and who loves order. The problem that we have is not so much that the evidence is not there, but that we refuse to follow the evidence. And it's not only the evidence of the nature of the cosmos or of life in the world. It's also the evidence from our experience of life in the world, isn't it? The fact that we feel guilt and shame. Well, we come up with alternative explanations, as Sigmund Freud did, that guilt is just a conflict within my mind. Myself beating myself up. One part of me beating the other part up. Rather than acknowledge that if I feel guilty, I've broken a law and there must be a lawgiver. That's where the law written on our hearts, as chapter 2 will say, comes in. Or my sense of fear of death and my sense of grief and loss and anger and injustice when someone I love dies. Well, I could just find an excuse for that, couldn't I, and say that, you know, fear of death is an evolutionary product to keep us away from dangerous situations and help us pass our genes on to more people. But of course, animals in the world don't fear death as humans do. They don't seem to be aware of it. We, as human beings, have an unusual fear of death. Well, where does that come from? Is that not an indicator of a greater reality? In other words, the world as we see it and life as we experience it is exactly what we would expect to see and experience if God created the world and if the story of the Bible about both creation and sin, which is the focus of this passage, were true. All of the evidence points in that direction. And when we do not follow it to that conclusion, well, the problem is not that the evidence isn't sufficient, it's that we have chosen to reject the possibility of that conclusion. And we do it because of unrighteousness. we do it because the conclusions of that come from that, if God is real, if God exists, then there is a moral standard that might not be convenient to me. If God is real, if God is true, then I am not the supreme authority. If God is real, if God is true, then I cannot manipulate God. I cannot control him. I have to submit to him and surrender to his authority. And that is an inconvenient truth for sinful human beings. So because of our unrighteousness, because we are not right with God, and because we are not aligned with what is right, then we are engaged in ungodliness. And of course, that is what God's wrath is revealed against. But we don't want to accept God's judgment upon us, God's righteous anger. And so we replace God. You see, we are without excuse, Paul says, verse 20. But verse 21, although they knew God, they didn't honour him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking and darkened in their foolish hearts. Now, what does this refer to? Well, I think you can take this right back to Genesis 3, can't you, with Adam and Eve and their sin and the consequences of that they rejected God. They knew him as their creator, but they didn't honour him as God. They believed the lie of the serpent who said, you can eat the fruit that God forbid and you can become like God, knowing good and evil, deciding for yourself. So instead of honouring God and giving thanks to him, they followed that deception. They followed a lie that said, you will become smarter, brighter. You will become more powerful. And in fact, the result of their sin was futility in their thinking and foolishness in their heart, cut off from the light of God. They claimed to be wise, but became fools. And it's not just Adam and Eve, of course. This is what happens every time a person rejects the obvious conclusion that there is a creator, that God exists, or what they have heard about God from the Bible or from a Christian who shared with them, and they walk away from it. They are walking into darkness. But in the futility of that thinking, what is right seems wrong. And what is wrong seems right. And in the foolishness of the heart, desires that were given by God for a good purpose become misdirected. Now, verse 23, of course, takes that further, that what human beings did was to exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Paul is talking about the idolatry that was part of the Greco-Roman world that he lived in, and the pagan world in the time of the Old Testament as well. But you might say, well, we don't have idols like that today, do we? But idolatry is just one expression of what Paul again says in verse 25, that they worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. Now, if you think about that, if you're going to worship a created thing, yes, you might think you can worship the sun as people in Ireland used to do before Christianity. You can worship the moon and the stars. You could worship animals and idols made to look like animals. But sooner or later, you will end up worshipping the greatest created thing, which is what? That is human beings themselves, even your own self. And although our culture today may not have many idols made of stone and wood, we have the deep idolatry of self-love, of self-worship, and we're encouraged in it. Actualize yourself, discover your true self that only you can know. Be true to yourself, express yourself. Be confident in yourself. And of course, the tragedy of that is that when God is not in the equation, when we have no reference point external to ourself, self-worship, self-love soon devolves into self-hatred and self-loathing. We find that the self is unworthy of worship, and we end up spiraling into despair. There is no satisfaction in the worship of self. What we need instead is the true God, the Creator, the holy, just, glorious, powerful God who created us, the one who is blessed forever. And Paul adds, Amen, at the end of verse 25. He can't help himself giving praise and worship to God. But when we follow this path away from God, when we reject God, when we exclude God from the equation, when we decide that we don't need God to explain the existence of the universe or our own existence, well, we are following a wrong belief. We are following wrong worship. And that wrong worship supports wrong beliefs. All sorts of ideas that are wrong, such as the idea that same-sex activity is natural for some people. You see, Paul says they exchange natural relations, verse 26 and 27, for those that are contrary to nature. In other words, when we understand God as the Creator, then we realize that our bodies have a purpose, and that every part of our body has a purpose, and that that purpose, when it comes to the sexual organs of our body, is for the union of a man and a woman within the context of marriage. Not the union of a man and a man, or a woman and a woman, or even of a man and woman outside marriage. If you ignore God, of course, then there is no such thing as a purpose for your body at all, is there? Other than the pleasure that you can get from it. Or maybe you might think the things you can do in it, which might even include good things to help other people. But the Bible tells us that your body has a higher, a greater purpose, which is to glorify God, to serve Him, to worship Him. And so from a Christian point of view, there is a proper and right and natural way to use the body, because we use it in the way that God created it for and God commanded. But without that, of course, this idea that we can use our bodies whatever way we like seems to be true, doesn't it? But from a biblical point of view, a gospel point of view, that is a wrong belief. So wrong worship supports wrong beliefs. Within our wrong worship, when we worship the creature rather than the Creator, then that belief seems right, that I can do whatever I like with my body because I worship myself, I worship humanity. And when we believe wrong ideas, then wrong desires seem right. Dishonourable passions, as verse 26 calls it, seem right to us. We find ways to justify it through beliefs, claims, which are based on wrong worship. And from those wrong desires come wrong actions. I do something wrong because my desires are misdirected, and I justify those wrong desires through wrong beliefs that flow from wrong worship. Do you see that? Wrong worship leads to wrong beliefs. Wrong beliefs justify wrong desires. Wrong desires, when I follow them, lead to wrong actions. In other words, there is a deeper problem here in sin rather than just my wrong actions. It's vitally important that we realize this, because going back to the question of same-sex activity, yes, we can say that same-sex activity is sinful. But many Christians will say, but same-sex attraction is not sinful. And I agree with them. It is not a sin to feel attraction to a person of the same sex, any more than it is a sin for me to look at a person of the opposite sex who is not my wife and be attracted to her. But it would be a sin if I started to say that that attraction signaled something about my identity. I am attracted to people of the same sex, therefore I am gay. Well, what does that mean from a biblical point of view? It means nothing. Identity does not come from desires. Desires have a proper direction. Sexual desire has a proper place for fulfillment in marriage between a man and a woman. Any other way of fulfillment is improper. That's not a question of identity. It's a question of temptation. It's a question of desire, of passion. But passions don't indicate identity. Again, I may struggle with a bad temper. Yes, it would be a sin for me to lash out in anger with hurtful words or physical violence. But if I started to say that bad temper is just part of who I am and it's justified because I am somehow superior to other people or, you know, whatever it may be, then those are wrong beliefs. Do you understand that? And ultimately, those flow from wrong worship. The fundamental belief that I can make a decision for myself. And so sin is much deeper than just our actions. And we have to be very careful, particularly when it comes to something like homosexuality, where I can say, yes, the activity is sinful. The attraction may not be sinful, but the belief that the desire is an indicator of who I am is a wrong belief, a sinful belief that doesn't make sense within an understanding of worshipping God, the Creator, because God did not make you that way. And therefore, those desires are a departure from God's intention. They ought to be unwanted, not approved of, not accepted as an indicator of my identity. I don't have to beat myself up because of them if I'm not following them, but I must not dwell on them and I must not endorse them. And that's true of any misdirected desire, whether that's towards anger or jealousy or malice. Those things are not part of who I am. They are part of my alienation from God. And of course, it is against ungodliness and unrighteousness that God's wrath is revealed. Verse 18, unrighteousness, the things that I do, yes. The sinful things I do anger God, but so does my false worship and my false beliefs. God's righteous holy anger is revealed against that. And I must understand this, by the way, that sin is not just some impersonal thing as if, you know, well, I've broken a law and therefore I'm guilty of breaking that law. Sin is a personal offence against the holy God who created us. He is offended. It is an act of rebellion against him every time I choose to do or to believe and reinforce a belief that is inconsistent with God's truth. That is an act of rebellion against God, and it angers God, and rightly so. His wrath, his intense burning anger against what is wrong is revealed against me. And so sin, according to this passage, is a bigger problem than I ever imagined. All of the excuses that I might have made, you know, when I say a crossword in a moment of tiredness and I make an excuse, well, because I'm tired, there is no excuse. My tiredness is no excuse. What I did was wrong. And my attempts to excuse and justify it are also wrong. I stand under the judgment of God. And if I don't know that from the nature of creation, then I ought to know it from the decree of God, because I have the privilege of having the scriptures and knowing what God has said about sin. I am foolish, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. That collection of lesses in verse 31. And until I own up to that and confess that, I cannot move on to know what Paul is going to go on and talk about, the forgiveness of God, the salvation that comes through Christ, through the gospel, which is God's power to save. First, I must acknowledge my sin without excuse. And as Paul goes on into chapter 2, he'll explain more of the nature of God's judgment and also of the universal problem of sin. But until I acknowledge that, I cannot come and receive forgiveness. Sin is not simply that I am broken, living in a broken world. It is that I am a breaker, a rebel against God, one who has walked away from him, who has worshipped other things, and who has offended him, and who stand guilty before him, deserving of death through his wrath, and calling out for mercy.